Center Point Church, who are we? We are the people of God, called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to the day when the rule of God covers the earth. 2 years ago, Snowvember rocked Western New York. The Buffalo area was hit especially hard, as cities around there got between 5 and 7 feet of snow in 1 week. In fact, there was so much snow that it was still on the ground in July. One man found out how dangerous that storm could be. His name was Donald. He was coming home from work in the middle of the night, got caught off guard by the storm, and found his car stuck in the snow at 3 a.m. So he calls for help, hoping that a tow truck can come and pull him out. But the problem is, the roads are so bad that the city had put a travel ban out. And so no tow truck, no AAA was going to be allowed to come and help him. So he was told to stay in his car. The authorities would eventually bring help. He was promised that that help would eventually come. Sadly, rescuers did come, but not until nearly 24 hours later. And when they arrived, they found that he had already passed away, waiting for the promised help that came far too late. A later report summed up the tragic event this way: Donald remained in his vehicle and died while waiting for help and assistance, which never arrived. It's hard to imagine a more helpless feeling, isn't it? You're sitting all alone in your car. It's dark. The snow and the wind is whipping outside your car, and you know that you are completely dependent on someone else to save you. And as the hours ticked on, I have to imagine that hope must have seemed more and more distant until finally it was gone. I have to think at some point this man had resigned himself to the reality that that promised help was not coming. Donald held on to the promise that help was on the way, but that promise was never fulfilled. Now, while I'm sure we've never personally experienced a tragedy like this, we have experienced what it's like to be let down by broken promises, haven't we? Especially during this political season, we're reminded again of just how easy it is to throw around promises that they may have no intention of keeping. If you elect me, I promise to fix the economy. Well, I promise to change this policy. No, I promise to keep you safe. I promise, and on, and yet we're skeptical, because our experience tells us that such promises often go unfulfilled. But it's not just politicians who let us down. Sometimes even those who care about us the most have hurt us with broken promises. Even we know what it's like to make promises that we can't keep. Parents, we've done it all, haven't we? I promise I'll take you to the park today. I promise I'll play with you today after work. I promise that I'll read that book to you. I promise. And yet inevitably something else gets in the way. And at times we break our promise. Or perhaps some of you have experienced the pain of a spouse who has broken the promise of faithfulness, or a friend who has betrayed your trust. And after a while, it's easy to adopt a rather cynical view of life, because we expect to be disappointed. Our experience tells us that it's better to be surprised by a promise that is actually kept than to be let down once again by one that is not. How tragic it would be to realize we have that same expectation about God and his promises. Now, of course, our first reaction is likely, that could never be. And yet, as we look around our world and we see so little evidence of God's kingdom, we can't help but wonder if maybe, just maybe, there really is reason to doubt what God has promised. Where's the justice and the righteousness we expect from his coming kingdom? Where's this rule of God that we talk about every week? Because most indications are that these things seem nowhere in sight. Our world appears to be in chaos. The line between right and wrong is blurred such that it seems like it doesn't even exist anymore. We have other religions that have made it their whole mission to oppose our God. And if we're honest, sometimes it seems like they're winning. And how many millions of God's people around the world are suffering in persecution, and yet to us it seems as if he is so silent. And then there's our experience. We struggle with the effects of sin. It beats us down. It discourages us. We try to please God with our lives, and yet sometimes it seems like all we have to show for it is more conflict and alienation. We know that God has promised in his word that he has a plan for the redemption of his people and of this world. And yet that just doesn't seem to square with reality. And so we're prone to question whether he will actually follow through with his promises. And we wonder, in a world of chaos, what hope do we have that God will actually bring about his promised blessing for his people? What hope do we have that God will actually do what he has promised that he will do for his people? This morning in our text, we're going to see the story of a man who found himself in a similar position of chaos. You see, God had promised this man that he would one day be king over his people, and yet his circumstances indicated a very different reality. Instead of being on the path to ruling, he's in fact running for his life. And by all accounts, his chances of survival, they're not good. No one would have blamed him if he had abandoned hope in God's promise, because in some ways it sure seemed like God had in fact abandoned him. That man is David. We see his story in 1 Samuel 23. In 1 Samuel 23, we're going to look at just how desperate his situation was and how God's promise seemed in doubt. And then we're going to see how God responds to his situation. And this response will remind and encourage us that indeed there is hope that God will keep the promises that he has made to his people. And then we will be invited to respond, both with some truths to believe and also some actions to take. And I trust we will be strengthened in our great God this morning as we seek to pursue his blessings together, continuing through the book of 1 Samuel. We'll be starting in verses 7 through 9. Again, this is 1 Samuel chapter 23. And in verses 7 through 9, we're going to be reminded that sometimes our circumstances cause God's people to doubt that he will really keep his promises. And we see this through a description of a dangerous time for David that brought God's promise to him into question. Verse 7. Now it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah. And Saul said, God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars. And Saul summoned all the people to war to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. David knew that Saul was plotting harm against him. Now let's remind ourselves of what David's been going through here recently. Now last week in chapter 20, Vic walked us through where we saw that Saul was determined to kill David. And so now David's on the run. He's with a group of men who are loyal to him. They're basically going from town to town, hiding wherever they can, because they know that if Saul finds David, he's going to kill him. In fact, he's so intent on this. We saw, if you would read a chapter previous, in chapter 22, Saul has 85 priests murdered just because they helped David. And so David knows this is no joke. This is no petty feud. Saul is intent on hunting him down and destroying him if it's the last thing that he does. And now, as we just read, David finds himself at Keilah, and he hears through the grapevine that Saul knows where he is and he's planning to come after him. Now, Keilah's not a good place to be if you're in David's shoes. It's a city that can be sealed. Now, if you're out in the wilderness, that's one thing. Now, you can spread out a little bit. There's more there. You can maybe find some crevices and some caves to hide in. But not this city. It's almost like being a bird in a cage. You're in there. You can fly around a little bit. But at some point, the paw of that cat is going to get you. You have nowhere to go. And so David asked the Lord for wisdom. Faced with this, faced with the reality that he is once again on the run, and that this promise of God that he would be king seems again in doubt, David asked the Lord for wisdom for what to do next. And we keep going in verse 9. And he said to Abiathar the priest, "Bring the ephod here." Then said David, "O Lord, the God of Israel, your servant has surely heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. Will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord, the God of Israel, please tell your servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down." But he only answers David's second question. So David asks again, "Will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will surrender you." Now, put yourself in David's shoes here. There are a couple of things that you might think are a little discouraging at this point. Now, first of all, the people of Keilah are about to rat him out to Saul. Now, that might not seem like all that bad until you consider why David is in Keilah in the first place. We would learn at the beginning of chapter 23 that David went to Keilah because he had heard the Philistines had attacked them. And so he chose, at great personal risk, both to himself and to his men, to go rescue them. And now, how do they repay that? They're going to turn right around and hand him over to Saul. It's the ultimate act of ingratitude. I think that might be a little discouraging. But there's something else that's probably a little confusing to David, and that's God's role in this whole thing so far. You know, earlier I said that David chose to go and save Keilah, but that's only partially true. Because it was actually God who told him to go and do it. God was the reason that David chose to go. And so you have to wonder if David's not thinking, "Wait a second, God. Okay, the only reason that I am here right now is because you told me to come. And now that I'm here, all it seemed to have done is to put this huge target on my back from Saul." Not only that, but what might we want to hear in the Lord's response to David in verses 11 through 12, if we're in David's shoes? Don't you think he might have liked to hear something like, "Yes, David, I understand that Saul knows where you are. The people of Keilah are going to betray you into his hand, but don't worry. I've got your back. Everything is going to be okay, and I will protect you." We'd like to hear that. And yet, as far as what the author records for us, all we have, and all David had, was the facts. There's really not much comfort. There's not a whole lot of assurance. Just the bare facts. This is what Saul knows, and this is what the people will do to you, and that's it. And so we might understand if David were grateful for the heads up yet perhaps a little confused why God maybe wasn't doing a little bit more to help. I mean, after all, David's the one that's putting his neck out on the line here because he believes that God's going to keep this promise that he made, that he's going to make him king. I mean, why else would he go to all this trouble of running from Saul and putting his life in danger? He could have thrown in the towel a long time ago. He could relinquish his claim to the throne. Just kidding, Saul. I don't even really want this anymore. Okay? If it means all that much to you, just take it. Leave me alone. You can have the throne. Let me go in peace. Maybe he would hope that Saul would give up, that his anger would disappear. He could just let David go on with his life and he could live peaceably. And yet, David continued day after day to trust that God's promise would indeed be fulfilled. And this, despite the fact that from all indications so far, there isn't a whole lot of assurance that God has some kind of plan here. All David sees is constant danger, a whole lot of running, and now, betrayal. And as he held out hope in God's promise of blessing, his obedience seemed to bring him nothing but conflict. We can relate to that, can't we? How many times have we found that as we seek to be obedient to God, that what it brings about is conflict? At work, we think, and Vic shared a little about this last week, maybe we, because of our integrity, we see that there's a problem, and yet because that problem would hurt the bottom line or because it would implicate some very powerful people, who's the person that gets punished? It's us. It's not the people that are doing wrong. We find that our integrity brings us into conflict with others. But then maybe we find that we're growing in Christ's likeness and we're choosing more and more to put devotion to God above the things of this world. And we find that for our friends and maybe even our family, that decision is met with curiosity, maybe even a distance. They're not comfortable with that devotion. We're a little bit too radical for them. But then we think about our brothers and sisters around the world whose devotion to God results in what seems to be the ultimate conflict. And they're put to death for doing nothing other than doing what they know to be right, for choosing devotion to God. And we want to choose that. And yet it seems like sometimes all that brings is more trouble than we bargain for. And we wonder, where is God in all of this? I mean, we know what he has promised to those who choose devotion to him, and yet we see so little evidence that those promises are coming about anytime soon. And so we find ourselves continuing to trust that God knows what he's doing, and yet all the while we wrestle with just how long our trust will hold out in the face of what we perceive around us. It's the situation David finds himself in here. He's got no other option but to trust that God has some sort of plan and hang on for the ride. And so he runs. He escapes from Keilah. He and his men settle in the wilderness at Ziph. He's safe from Saul for now. Saul gives up the chase. But he's not safe for long. Because if you can believe it, his situation is actually about to go from bad to worse. Let's pick up the story back in verse 19. Then the Ziphites, again, this is where David has escaped to. The Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh, on the hill of Hakilah, which is south of Jeshimon? Now come down, O king, according to all your heart's desire to come down, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand." Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? And Saul said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, for you have had compassion on me. Go, make yet more sure. know and see the place where his foot is and who has seen him there, for it is told me that he is very cunning. See therefore and take note of all the lurking places where he hides and come back to me with sure information. Then I will go with you. And if he is in the land, I will search him out among all the thousands of Judah. And they arose and went to Ziph ahead of Saul. Now David and his men were in the wilderness at Maon in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. And David and Saul and his men went to seek him. And David was told. So he went down to the rock and lived in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. This is not looking good here for David. And Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain, and David was hurrying to get away from Saul. It's going to start feeling like a little bit of deja vu for David, doesn't it? Because just when he manages to escape one city's betrayal, he's right in the middle of it again. But there's something different about this time. There's something different about Saul's plan this time around. Because you see, he knows that David is a slippery little feller. And so what does he do? What's the whole point of this little back and forth and making sure the messengers are double checking what David's doing? The point is that this plan will not fail. Saul's going to make sure of it. He has done all of his research that he can possibly do. He has gathered intelligence. He has scouted his army. He has planned out the exact military formation that will not fail. Saul has done everything humanly possible to ensure that David will not escape again. He has him. And then he and his men go in for the kill. And that's it. I mean, it has to be. There can be no escape for David this time. He has 600 men. And at this point, Saul probably has at least 3,000 men. And you can see where this is going. David is on one side of the mountain. Saul and his men are on the other. And so Saul's men are going to go around both sides of the mountain. They're going to completely surround David and his men. They're going to slaughter every last one of them. And David will be destroyed. It is inconceivable that anything other than that can happen. It would take an unbelievable act of God to save David now, to keep his promise intact now. And that's exactly what happens. Just in the nick of time, you see in verse 27, a messenger comes out of nowhere and he delivers the only news that could stop Saul in his tracks. Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid against the land. The Philistines are attacking the homeland, so Saul has no choice. He's so close, he has him finally right in his sights. David cannot escape. And yet he is forced to turn around. Disaster is averted, and God's promise endures. You know what's really interesting? That now that we see that God's promise does come through, that he does keep what he had promised to David, we're able to look back on the whole story from a totally different perspective. Think about it with movies that we watch for the first time. When we don't know what's going to happen, when we don't know how it ends, every little twist and turn, every little bad thing that happens to our favorite characters, we're on the edge of our seat, right? Are they going to live? Are they going to get away from the bad guy? Are they going to fall in love? We don't know. And so we're hanging on, and every little thing has us wondering, what's coming next? Oh, that doesn't look good. How is that going to affect? Oh. Until finally, the end. And we see the resolution. And when our favorite character does survive or they do get together, we can look back and watch it a second time and think, oh, I know that looks bad right now. Okay, that's scary, but I know how this ends. It's going to turn out okay. It's the same thing when you watch a sporting event that you've already seen. It's fun. I shouldn't admit this, but I've probably watched the Ohio State Buckeyes 2 playoff games from last season probably about 20 times on YouTube since then. Because it's glorious. You know why? Because it doesn't matter how many boneheaded plays we make. It doesn't matter how gloomy the outcome seems, how difficult it seems like we're actually going to pull it out. I know we win. I know. And so I can watch and sit back and think, you know what? I know this doesn't look good now. I don't really see how it's going to work out now, but I do know how it ends. And it's going to be okay. It's the same thing in this story. When we know how it ends, when we know that God does, in fact, keep his promise to David, we can see the story in a whole different light. I mean, think about it. Now, instead of chaos all throughout as he's running, we see the clear intervention of a God who was in control the whole time. He knew exactly what was going to happen to David, and whenever danger came his way, God made sure that he was protected. But we also see the creativity of our God as he intervened for David. I mean, the first time he saved him, it was by telling him to run away. Now, that's not exactly glamorous, but it got the job done, didn't it? And then as Saul's army is bearing down on David, God intervenes using the most unlikely of rescuers. Israel's sworn enemies, the Philistines. Now, I'm sure David would have preferred God to detour Saul a long time ago. But something tells me that close call was also by design. Because any other solution to David's problem might have been attributed to something or someone other than God. But when David and his men were at the point of no return, completely out of options, completely at the mercy of the only one who could save them, when it happened, there is no doubt it was God who intervened. So what are we to make of all of this? I would suggest that the way God kept his promise to David should serve as a powerful reminder, a powerful encouragement of God's ability to still keep his promises to his people today. And in particular, we've seen at least two truths here that we can cling to when we're tempted to question the certainty of his promises. First, God is in control. True, our circumstances might not make a lot of sense. We might not always understand how God could possibly use all of this chaos that we see around us to bring about his program. But through it all, we can trust that nothing is happening outside of the knowledge and control of God. Of course, I mean, that doesn't make the chaos disappear. But it can give us a proper perspective in the midst of that chaos. That even when we don't understand what God is doing, we can have trust that he does know what he's doing. God is in control. Second, God intervenes for his people. 1,000 times a day, in ways that we will never know, God is at work in the lives of his people as he advances his plan. As he did with David, he guides his people, he strengthens them, he fights for them. Now, does that mean that God is going to intervene all the time and solve all of our problems in this life? No, we know that. But it does mean that we can expect God to be actively involved in human history to ensure that his promises to his people will not fail. He's done it before when he sent his son to die on the cross for our sins, to make a way for redemption as part of his plan. And we can trust that he will do it again one day when he ultimately intervenes. And he sends his son again, this time to rid the world of sin and death and establish God's righteous rule on the earth. And so what do we do with all of this? What is our response to this today? In the midst of a world that is broken, in the world that seems to be controlled by nothing but chaos, and we're struggling to find hope that God will keep his promises to his people, what do? We remember that we are part of a story whose ending is known. We don't have to be on the edge of our seats wondering if this disaster or that disaster is putting God's promise in doubt. We know the end. God wins. And one day he is going to say enough. And this kingdom that he has promised will be fully realized. And friends, we will live with him forever. There will be no sadness, no sickness, no death. Just we and our King forever. And so our hope in the here and now does not come from a what. It comes from a who. We're not going to find much hope in what we can understand about what God is doing. If we're looking for hope in what we can figure out about God's plan, there's not going to be much to find. But if our hope is in the one who knows the end from the beginning and who holds the universe in the palm of his hands, there is indeed great hope to be found as we rest in him. Paul Tripp expresses this beautifully when he writes, "We all face things that appear to make little sense and don't seem to serve any purpose. But rest is never found in the quest to understand it all. No, rest is found trusting the one who understands it all and rules it for his glory and our good. In moments when you wish you knew what you can't know, there is rest to be found." And so, friends, as we struggle to understand exactly what God is doing and how he's going to bring about the promises he's made to his people, and in spite of what we see swirling around us, we are challenged not to focus on the severity of our circumstances. But instead, we can find refuge and hope in our God, who is in control and who intervenes for his people. And as we continue journeying through this life, seeking to pursue God's blessing together, may this be our prayer, as it was David's. "For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from him. He is my rock and my salvation only, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us." Amen.